A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to Owning It, the Anxiety Podcast. Do you struggle with perfectionism? Do you really understand the science around it? I, for one, didn't. Are you more of a socially prescribed perfectionist or a self-oriented perfectionist? And what does that even mean? In this episode with Professor of Psychology at the London School of Economics and TED Talker Tom Curran, we get really granular on the subject of perfectionism. The latest research, whether it differs across genders, and most importantly, how we can manage our tendency towards perfectionism, which, of course, can result in higher levels of daily anxiety. If you're loving the series, can you do me a massive favor? It just helps so much when my listeners actually make the effort to click the subscribe button. I would really appreciate if you could do this. Also, I have set up a Substack, which is entirely reader funded and really helps to keep this podcast going. I'm writing about anxiety, obviously, and confidence and the fear of failure, public speaking, that kind of thing, and parenting, careers, and lots more. You can join me there at carolineforan.substack.com/subscribe and get a little bit more than you do with this podcast. For now, let me introduce you to Tom. When I was watching your TED talk, did I pick up on like a slight Irish accent, or am I totally imagining that?
My dad's Irish.
Oh, there we go.
There you go. So that's the Irish connection. But I've been all over the place. My accent is an amalgamation of quite a few different places. And one of the beauties of that is that no one can place me. So very well done for detecting the Irish.
Yeah, I'm proud of that one. I think it must just be in our blood that we can hear. We can hear our kind wherever we go. So yeah, thank you so much for joining me. I'm so excited to talk about perfectionism. It's a subject that comes up again and again, as it's such a massive driver of anxiety. And obviously the nature of this podcast is to help people, you know, better navigate the anxiety that they feel. And sometimes like perfectionism, it might not be the source of like, you know, your major strife. You know, there might be other lifestyle things going on, such as a really tough work environment or a relationship or any number of reasons. But perfectionism, I find, can just sort of be that top layer that seems like innocuous, but actually can chip away. And for me anyway, can really start to just give you this daily hum of background anxiety. So I'm excited to get just stuck into it all with you. I'd love first if you could tell my listeners. So in the bio, it describes you as like the foremost world expert on perfectionism. Can you tell me how you wound up becoming or being at this point in your life as an expert?
Well, that's the sell job. Yeah. I myself, not sure about that. There are many, many researchers in this area, and I certainly stand on the shoulders of giants when it comes to the perfectionism area. But at the moment, I guess you would say a lot of the work that I've done has reached prominence on the back of some big studies that find that perfectionism is increasing over time. Perfectionism is very much sort of the modern zeitgeist. How did I get there? Oh, gosh. Well, long story short, very lucky. A lot of hard work, obviously, but I grew up in a working class background. Didn't necessarily see myself as going to university, never mind being an academic, but managed to get good grades, came through when kids like me were supported to go to university, various grants and whatnot. So thought, why not? I met the right people at the right time. I was invited to do a PhD. And that's really where I started to take off in terms of my academic career. And one of the things I was really interested in as I got into the academic system, became very competitive. And like you just mentioned there, had a lot of background anxiety about whether I'm good enough, whether I'm working hard enough and all the rest of it, was that perfectionism was really something that's impacting my psychological well-being. And I saw it all around me too. Like, it wasn't just me, it was everyone else. So I was kind of, yeah, I mean, that was the impetus really to go, okay, well, let's have a look at this a little bit deeper. Let's see what's happening here. And is this something that's holding us back? And is this something that perhaps is the new zeitgeist? And that's where we are.
It's like, congratulations for getting the PhD. It's so interesting and fascinating to be able to dive into a subject that you're passionate about, especially when you can bring your own personal experience to it as well. For me, I mean, I feel like with this podcast, I get sent a lot of books and things about perfectionism or people pleasing, that kind of thing. And I'm just curious, for you, what did you feel was not explored, or what did you come across in your study that you thought we hadn't really uncovered yet? Because I think we're all kind of familiar with the idea of, you know, that perfectionism is not our friend, even though, well, I know you say as well, a lot of us kind of hold it up as this badge of honor. But what did you want to, or what did you uncover that you found kind of was a little bit different?
Yeah, I think there's numerous kind of myths around perfectionism in modern culture, and conventional wisdom says that perfectionism is a necessary evil. So this idea that, okay, we know at some level it holds us back, there's some emotional baggage, and it's not very good for our psychological well-being. I think everyone kind of accepts that. But then at the same time, we live in a world that demands perfection and kind of, well, not kind of, rewards the overachiever. And so there's a part of the perfectionism that a lot of people look to and almost lionize. Say, actually, you know what, you got to get through the pain. You got to suffer and work in discomfort if you want to achieve anything in this world. And really, for me, the biggest thing that I want to do with both in the book and my own research is to bust that myth once and for all. Because when you look at the data, you don't see any relationship to perfectionism and performance at all. And that's really curious. And a lot of people scratch their heads at that finding, but it actually makes sense when you delve a little bit deeper into what perfectionism actually is, starting from, you know, it's a deficit, form of deficit thinking, where we're not good enough and we feel like we have to please people all the time.
Okay, so let's just start at the definition then. I mean, I think people think that they understand it. What for you is that its most basic explanation, I suppose, of how you define perfectionism?
Yeah, it's that deficit thinking. It's this idea that in order to be worth something, in order to matter, I have to be perfect, because if I'm not, people are going to see, they're going to judge me, they're going to let me know. Mm-hmm. And that will unveil to the world this imperfect, flawed person that deep down I know I am, that I'm burying. And that's really hard. That's a really challenging way to live, because if you live in service of other people's approval all the time, you're going to try and be perfect to get that approval. But of course, perfection is an impossible goal, so we often fall short, we often fail, we have to hit setbacks and shortcomings, so we feel bad about ourselves, self-esteem plummets, and we overcompensate. Perfectionists do this all the time, overcompensate to try to make up for the setback or failure that we just encountered. But of course, now our goals are even higher, so we're not going to meet them again, and so begins this very negative spiral. Mm-hmm. And really at root, that's what perfectionism is. And that's what
it's not being, needing to know that we are good enough.
Exactly. Yeah. Just trying at all times to prove to everyone and all around us that we are enough.
Did you notice in your research, is it in any way imbalanced in either gender? Like, is it more of a female tendency, or is it a big issue for men as well? Or is it even more so for men?
This is a really good question. I get it a lot. We try to do a lot of work to differentiate to find out whether perfectionism levels can be differentiated across genders, and there's been so many studies now. And what's really interesting is that there's no consistent finding. Levels tend to be more or less the same, mm-hmm. Which surprises some people, surprised our group actually. But again, you know, it's one of those things where I think what's happening here is that when it comes to actual levels of perfectionism, there seems to be some consistency. But when you look outside in the world, and and understand that perfectionism isn't just about mean levels, but it's also about cultures and environments that we exist in. That there's an interaction going on here, and it is quite possible that even though mean levels are the same, there are societal expectations for perfection that weigh a lot heavier on girls and females, more so than they do on males. There's certainly that conversation to be had, and there's all sorts of areas of life where it's evident, particularly in the appearance domain, where you could argue that these things are these work pressures are much weightier when it comes to girls and females.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's, I guess, there's a lot of Venn diagrams where there's like cultural influences and everything like that. What did your studies involve? How did you gather this information that first perfectionism was a problem, that it was a problem, that it was becoming more of a problem, and what the impact, what was happening to us as a result of this widespread perfectionism?
Yeah, there's so many ways you can go about it. The most common way is to look at just a straightforward questionnaire. So we measure perfectionism on a what's called a Likert scale. And by the way, that is how perfectionism, we consider perfection to be a spectrum. So some will be higher, some will be lower. Most people will be in the middle. And what we're interested to know is, well, can we use those perfection measures to explain variability in some outcomes like anxiety, depression, performance, and all the rest of it? And when you do that, you find relationships between those things, high relationships between perfectionism and mental health outcomes, but also negligible to no relationship between performance, as we just mentioned. But also you can use that spectrum in a very interesting way too. So not only can we get an idea of the correlations with outcomes, but we can also find out whether it's changing over time, because what you have essentially is a distribution of perfectionism as a mean and standard deviation. And what we find when we string out all the data that we can possibly find across many, 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 many decades is that it's that middle part of the distribution, the mean, that seems to be moving upwards. And that's how we can tell that perfectionism seems to be getting more pervasive among young people, because they seem to be reporting higher average levels of perfectionism over time. And so there's many ways we can explore these things, but those are the two main ones.
And is there a particular age group then that you're looking at?
Yeah, so this is young people, college students, because college students have some very similar characteristics across generations. So we can hold those things constant while looking at mean changes.
And even though it mightn't have been part of your research, just as having studied it so much yourself, do you think perfectionism like tapers off over time? As we get older, we kind of calm down a bit and we realize we don't want the phrase I heard, which I love, don't let the perfect get in the way of the good.
Yeah, we don't know, because there's not many life course studies that have tracked perfectionism over many, many people across their whole lives, which is a shame, because that would be a really interesting thing to know. What we do know is that most personality characteristics are fairly stable over time.
Okay.
However, interestingly, neuroticism tends to ameliorate with time, which is an interesting finding, because neuroticism is quite closely linked to perfectionism. However, the few studies that we do have looked at perfectionism at early life and then more sort of symptoms of perfectionism at later life. And what we tend to see is actually something interesting happens with perfectionism, doesn't happen with neuroticism, is that perfectionistic people tend to get more irritable, more anxious as they age. And that, I think, is because of this reinforcing nature of perfectionism, you know, this kind of cyclical nature where the high goals lead to more failure, lower self-esteem, overcompensation, and all the rest of it. So we don't know. There's no definitive answer to this, but we think perfectionism might actually get worse as we age rather than better, which is a bit of a concern.
Yeah, we'll cut that bit out. Do you differentiate between, when you talk about perfectionism there, it's sort of internal, like I need to do a good job, I need this podcast to be perfect, I need to, you know, whatever, versus I'm, like you mentioned, irritable, like I'm, my environment is not perfect here, I don't think this other person has done a good enough job, like holding other people, I guess, to perfectionist standards, or this so like is that all encompassed, or is there like this internal and there's external, or how do you explain that?
Yeah, this is really a good observation. And actually, when we talk to perfectionistic people, it's exactly what they tell us, that perfectionism isn't just something that comes from within us, even though perfectionistic people feel a high degree of self-imposed pressure to be perfect. It also comes from the outside too. So So perfection people often say, not only do I want to be perfect, but also everybody expects me to be perfect. Like everybody and all around me is watching and they're ready to pounce when I haven't been perfect. So I've got to hold high standards all the time. This is called socially prescribed perfectionism. Socially prescribed, coming from outside. But it's not just the pressures that we feel are imposed on us from outside, but also we also impose pressures on other people too. So if I expect you to be perfect and nothing but perfect, and those are my standards that I hold for you, that's called other-oriented perfectionism. So this is kind of what Freud would call projection. I'm projecting my own high self standards onto you. So these self-oriented perfectionism, high self-set perfectionism coming from within, as we mentioned, socially prescribed, feeling like it's coming from outside, and other-oriented, imposing perfectionism onto other people. These are the three core dimensions of perfection we understand to be this kind of broad perfectionistic personality. And so you're absolutely right. It's not just personal, it's also social.
So could someone be not, what was the word for when it's internal?
Self-oriented perfectionism. Yeah.
So could someone not be self-oriented, but like grow up in a family where it's socially prescribed to them and then just sort of inherit that or feel anxiety because that's not their nature, but they're having to live up to this standard? I know we're getting super complex here, a lot of webs crossing over here. But is that something you've observed as well?
Not at all. This is exactly the most interesting thing about perfectionism. There's no one size fits all. Mm-hmm. So on these various spectrums of perfectionism, you could be really high on social but low on self and maybe in the middle of other, and that's your particular constellation. Okay. Or you could be low on social, really high on self, and in the middle of other again. Like this is, everybody would have their own lie somewhere on their own spectrums of perfectionism, and there's no kind of one, this is what perfectionists look like. There's all sorts of many different flavors of perfectionism.
And when you were saying it was kind of mostly questionnaire based, like what if someone's listening to this thinking, oh, I don't know if maybe I do have perfectionist tendencies, or I thought it was a good thing. What kind of questions could someone ask of themselves to get a sense of whether it's maybe more maladaptive than doing them a favor?
Well, there's many different tools out there that you can Google. In my book, The Perfection Tribe, you have a sort of example test, a battery of questions that we typically ask. What I encourage people to do with this exercise at all times is not to try and put a score on it, even though we researchers,
then they're being perfectionists.
Yeah, even though we researchers have to deal with means and averages and all the rest, means and standard deviations and all the rest of it, it's important that you don't, because I think what the most important thing is to think about those questions that we ask. So for instance, one of the questions for self-oriented is I strive to be perfect. One of the questions for other-oriented is that I expect other people to be perfect. And one of the examples for socially prescribed is everyone around me expects me to be perfect. Now, the important thing to do is think about these items. Just think about it in your mind and to what extent you agree with them. So some people agree really strongly, like, yeah, that's me. Other people will be, no, I don't do that at all. I disagree with that statement. And some will be more or less in the middle, you know, sometimes yes, sometimes no. So this is the important thing to think about. Not necessarily I'm a four on this, but actually, you know, do I agree or disagree with this statement? And you know, over multiple statements, you can begin to get a picture in your mind as to whether you're a particularly perfectionistic person, not perfectionist, but a particularly perfectionistic person. And well, there's no such thing as perfectionists and non-perfectionists. We're all on the spectrum. Some will be more perfectionistic than others. Some will be less perfectionistic than others. But everybody has at some level will have a degree of intolerance for, you know, imperfect performances or outcomes or whatever it might be. Like basically everybody has a certain standard. You know, it wouldn't be the case that you would score absolutely nothing on each of these items. But at the same time, it wouldn't be the case that you'd score really high on all of them either. That would be a very extreme case. We're all on a spectrum somewhere.
So do you think it's problematic that people label someone as a perfectionist?
I wouldn't say it's problematic. You know, it's a good shorthand way to describe. I mean, certainly in the book, it's a shorthand way to describe somebody who is perfectionistic. Absolutely. You can get really into the semantics here, and I think it's important that in broadly listeners remember that really this is a sliding scale. Right. And you know, it's not really a good way to think about it is not as, okay, I'm a perfectionist, because that gives you something hard and fast. A good way to think about it is that I have perfectionistic tendencies. I seem to be trending quite high on this particular element of perfectionism. So there's a recognition there that perhaps there are ways in which we can manage the more negative aspects of that those tendencies.
Okay. How do you draw the conclusion that, say, our generation is more perfectionist, or it's becoming more of an issue, with like saying, well, that's maybe the reason, or that the reason we're more anxious is partly to do with that. How do you?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a generational piece to this. And I mean, the whole second part of my book really is trying to explore what's happening right now, why levels of perfectionism increasing. And you're absolutely right there. You just hit the nail on the head. Social media is a big component of this. It's limitless images of like perfect lives and lifestyles beamed at us 24/7. Of course, it's going to have an impact. But it isn't just social media, right? So there's other areas of life that are really excessively pressurized now. The workplace, very insecure. People move from job to job, never get a sense of rooting or community because we have to keep moving, we have to keep going, we have to keep striving, we have to keep grinding, hustling, all the rest of it. Work, the schools and education system right now is so pressurized. Elite college admission rates are down, so it means that it's harder to get in those elite places than what it used to be. So that's put a lot of pressure on young people to do well all the time in schools, college. Parenting practices are changing too because they see that pressure and they pass it down to their children in terms of excessive expectations, which we're also seeing in the data. So there's all sorts of reasons right now why pressures are really high on young people. There's an expectation that's not quite matching with reality in terms of what they should have, where they should be in life. And I think that's impacting not just on their perfectionism. They're telling us, everyone expects me to be perfect. Socially prescribed perfectionism is rising really quickly, and that's completely not inevitable perception of the world right now because it is highly expectant. But it's also important for their well-being too, because it does have an impact on their mood, their levels of anxiety,
So it's kind of
and their mental health.
a necessary evil.
I wouldn't say it's necessary. Like I think it's just a normal, natural response to pressures out there in the bigger, wider world.
Okay.
I think it's a collective responsibility actually for us to try to address these issues. And understand why young people seem to be struggling, not just young people, everybody right now,
Yeah.
why they seem to be struggling, and do something about it. Because I do think we call it in the book, an epidemic.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
I feel just from just not researching it in any great way, but we've so much more awareness of mental health now. We're having so much more conversations about how we don't need to be perfect, or how we're so hard on ourselves, or imposter syndrome, all these different things. When you compare it to like the idea, especially in the workplace, of like the 80s and 90s in like New York, where it was like you worked yourself to the bone and that was your badge of honor. And if you weren't, I remember reading this book, if you have to cry, go outside, and you couldn't be vulnerable and you had to just show up all the time. Do you think like the rise in talking about mental health has kind of helped to stop it? Would it be so much worse if it weren't for that? Like I'm actually surprised that it's getting worse with the more we are talking about it. and people being like cognizant of that.
And it's puzzling, isn't it? But it seems to be, 2008 was a big watershed moment. A lot of the data seems to converge around 2008 being a very significant year for young people, where levels of happiness and well-being seem to plateau, taper off, and indices of mental health seem to rise. And that includes, by the way, perfectionism. Perfection really skyrockets after that year.
Wow.
Something broke in 2008 and has never been repaired. And that was essentially growth. Economic growth has stagnated, particularly in the UK. Young people for the last 20 years have never lived in an economy where wages have consistently risen. That's to say that their standard of living is deteriorated year on year on year. We live in an economy where, for the first time on record, young people will be worse off than their parents. They will have to work far harder for far longer just to have the same standard of living. They can't afford housing. They have to put off having families because they don't feel a sense of stability in their working lives and also in their material financial lives. And that's different to the 80s. You know, the 80s were tough, don't get me wrong. And there were certainly many cultural issues around all sorts of areas. Particularly as you mentioned there, a reluctance to speak about mental health problems. But at the same time, people were working to the bone in an economy that was giving them something back. When the economy did well, they did well too. They had access to housing. They had a hangover from the social provisions of the post-war consensus, and that's to say that they, you know, labor protections, unions, they had things in their lives that gave them a safety net and allowed them to ascend. That's to say, move up the social hierarchy, get themselves into things that we might consider the good life, like a house, a stable job, have a family, and all the rest of it. Things that we know are really healthy for our sense of purpose, self-respect, and well-being. Mm-hmm. So the issues that we're seeing today are really issues of an economy that's secularly slowing down, and the expectations that are way out of whack with what is in reality a really tough place to grow up into. And that's why I say it's a collective responsibility. You know, this is an issue that we all need to grasp and understand how we can provide young people with a sense of purpose and optimism in a world that's not giving them much back. And I think that if you want an answer to what's happening right now in terms of mental health, I think that's the broader, more macro explanation.
Okay. You have a chapter in the book called Hustle is a Six-Letter Word. Talk to me a bit about that.
That's really about jobs in the modern world. That's and about the insecuritization of work and how work has become really a part of our identities, but not just work. Work in terms of a lifestyle. Work in terms of something that we wear, a bit like our perfection, that we wear as a badge of honor. You know, this never used to be the case. I work a bit in working class community. My father and my grandfather were carpenters, and they would never really wear their work as a badge of honor on their sleeve. They just did every day. They made everyday things to leave in the world for other people to use and appreciate. And that was their vocation. That was their purpose. And they did that with a very patient, humble determination. It's very different to the way I would consider myself as a worker in the modern workplace and most people that I interact with, where, you know, we're wearing it on our sleeve and we're worried all the time. We're apprehensive about how we're doing and whether we're doing enough or whether we're hustling or grinding hard enough. And, you know, you speak to people, you hear this all the time, like, you know, fake it till you make it. This is very common, like what you hear young people say. And this is just an expression of their perfectionism in the workplace, this apprehension that they aren't there on merit or they're not quite good enough and that everybody and all around them is going to notice. So they have to kind of fake this hyper competency, this, you know, productive, perfect worker who hustles and grinds and stays up late and all the rest of it, just to get by in the workplace. And I think that's really indicative of I would say an unhealthy relationship with work, a very perfectionistic relationship with work, where our sense of self is intertwined with the outcomes of our working lives.
So it sounds like, well, for one, it sounds like we're largely fucked because it's so it's so driven into us. And it's, you know, like you say, there's this scarcity. And if we feel like we have to be perfect in order to like secure these things that so that we can provide for ourselves, it's it's not something we can just say, right, I'm just going to wake up tomorrow and no longer have perfectionist thinking. But it sounds like really, first of all, understanding it is key, knowing where you fall maybe on the spectrum. And also, like, talk to me about, I remember reading about like maladaptive versus adaptive perfectionism, because in some ways a perfectionism can't be a bad thing. Like people, you know, athleticism, athletes, that kind of thing, you know, it's not always, it can't all be all bad, right? Because then why, if it was so bad for us, we would like surely have evolved to just like be way more chill.
Well, we are social creatures. And we are impacted profoundly by environmental factors outside of us. I give an example in the book of Lance Armstrong, if you want a sporting context example, and his reasons for doping. You know, there's nothing hardwired about wanting to enhance your oxygen levels in your blood through EPO. But he was operating and competing in a context where every single person and all around him was doing that. And when you live inside a culture, you are so consumed by the absurdities of that culture that you scarcely recognize them as absurdities at all. But when you look closer, you can see that what was happening in Lance's case was a arms race, which made no one athlete more likely to succeed. But nevertheless, every single athlete felt compelled to do it. Because if they didn't, then they would be excommunicated. They would be falling down through the peloton. They wouldn't be able to compete. And that's the same as what's happening right now in broader culture. I don't think there's anything hardwired at all about perfectionism. I think it's something that's accentuated, amplified, and celebrated in modern society. Certainly, in order, you know, when you just look around you. I mean, just look around you. Social media, advertising. It's work, as I mentioned, schools, colleges, all the rest of it, everywhere and all around us expects overachievement, exceptionalism, perfection. And it's really difficult to not go with the herd when everybody around you is behaving in this way, is kind of pushing themselves well beyond comfort. So, you know, the data is clear about perfection, by the way, in performance. There is no link. So then it becomes curious as to why we think it's you know, it's necessary for success. And the reason I think is because we see all around us this 0.1%, you know, the unicorn achievers, the people that made it through some brutal selection process. But what we don't see is underneath those celebrated winners, the people that aren't featured on the podcast or given a platform on television shows, these are people who have the same traits, the same perfectionistic tendencies, but without Olympic medal, podium position, glittering book deal or whatever to show for it. And they're striving in significant discomfort with very little gain. And we have to be really careful about that selection effect. It's called survivor bias, because it can dupe us into thinking that perfectionism is what made these people rise to the top. But actually what happened there was their circumstances. They were in the right place at the right time. They had a lot of luck along the way. Yes, they worked hard, but they just happened to meet the right people at the right time. If we're talking about athletics, they had the right genes. Mm. Some people are just born with, you know, a fantastic lung capacity, and they can ride up hills ridiculously quickly. And that's just fate. And fate's
so we have a very skewed perception of, I guess, giving perfectionism too much credit for the success that we see others have.
Yeah, because everyone carves a life narrative. And of course, when you ask, well, how did you get to the top? Well, I worked really hard, and I had excessively high standards, and I shoot for the stars and all the rest of it. And I'm sure they did those things. I have no doubt they did those things, but they don't. What they don't talk about is the stuff that was also important. You know, just happened to be born in the right place at the right time, right? Like circumstances.
This is why I have an issue with people talking about like they just manifested their success. I'm like, okay, fine. Like, you know, there's so much more to it. Like your position, your privilege, your background, your experience, you know, your luck, your hard work as well. And it's just sort of diminished to like, oh, so, well, that's probably the flip side of perfectionism. That's just, I just thought it and it happened. And maybe that would be the antidote to perfectionism if we just like completely left it up to the universe. You talk in towards the end of the book about this post-perfectionist society, which sounds just divine. What does that look like to you, and how do we get there?
Well, this is more of a thought experiment than anything else. And one of the things I'm getting feedback on for this version is I think people are taking this chapter a bit too literally, as if I genuinely think we can live in this kind of utopia. I don't think we can. But what I wanted people to do is think about it. Think about what life would be like in a different kind of society and whether we would need as much perfectionism to get by. Because that helps us recognize to what extent this is a social construct. This is something that is demanded upon us by the world around. So I talk about how, you know, well, what if we lived inside the recognized human and planetary limits that didn't always have to grow all times and forever, that sometimes, you know, there were certain industries that would grow that are very healthy, certain industries that would decline that aren't very healthy. And we live in a kind of sustainable, what's called a donut economy, where, you know, growth isn't the be all and end all. What if we had priorities other than goods and services? What if, you know, we wanted to make sure that prosperity was measured by human wellness? So things like happiness, well-being, life expectancy, you know, employment, all the rest of it. All these things are really important for human flourishing, but we don't measure them as indexes of success in society. That's GDP. There are other things I talk about, UBI, putting a floor under deprivation, job sharing, working fewer hours, maintaining certain levels of productivity, which you've seen in the 4-hour work week, using technology like AI to enhance our lives, as to say, free us from the drudgery of work and allow us to spend more time in our communities, almost like an AI dividend that's shared with the people rather than siphoned upwards, but for shareholders. Mm-hmm. All sorts of, look, you know, there are many, many things I discuss in that chapter, but I think the main point I want to recognize, underscore, is that actually this is not a manifesto, it's a thought experiment. And if we can think about like a different society, then do we need as much perfectionism in that society? And I think the answer would be no.
From what you're saying, it sounds to me like a huge part of the problem is like this globalization, that we suddenly have access to like millions of other people's outfits and opinions and voices, whereas maybe we had perfectionism when we were just in our tribe or our village. But I was only comparing myself to like Mary down the road. I wasn't comparing myself to like the elite in the world, which I do now. Do you think that like a post-perfectionist society, kind of almost, we need to make our world smaller? Like you mentioned community there, going back there, or do you think perfectionism would be more likely because we can put a name to it, if we know who Mary is? So like, I'm going to be more competitive, whereas will I be less perfectionist in general? Because I'm like, okay, well, I'm not a Kardashian, so I'm not going to try and relate to her. Like, which is the better scenario for perfectionism?
Well, I'm a big advocate for community, spending time with people who we love and working together for common causes that we think are really important or that interest us. Those are things that have been disconnected in our world through the advent of social media. And this is why the loneliness epidemic, by the way, we have right now is so rife, is because we're constantly engaged online, away from the outside world. And I think reconnecting with those things is so, so important. And I think not only will that help us mentally, but also I think it will help us tremendously with perfectionism, because like you said, we're not comparing with impossible ideals, people whose lives are many, many thousands of miles away, who we have very little in common with, certainly very little ability to reach what they have. But because they're put on a pedestal, because they're celebrated as the ideal, then we go back into our own little lives and think that we're somehow inadequate. I think reconnecting with our communities grounds us and teaches us actually what we have right now in this moment is enough. And that the only thing that matters, the only thing that can matter, are those things, you know, being surrounded by people that we love, enjoying time in nature, in our communities. Those are the most important things, in my opinion, of life. And I think we are disconnected from them in a global, interconnected, technologically mediated world. And that's definitely had an impact on perfectionism.
Mm-hmm. We talk about, and you talk about it in the book, you know, this need for more like self-acceptance and I guess just reframing your expectations and your standards and like the ways that we read about to let go of perfectionism or turn the volume down on it. But is there any research or data that shows what actually, how successful that is? What happens when we do, or what is the best way to do that? And what does it look like when we do?
There's loads of evidence for things that are aligned to a sense of self-acceptance being accepting ourselves for who we are in this moment right now. And that comes in various different forms, but I think the main one is self-compassion, self-kindness. And you know, if you say accept yourself, then you're able to see that you're not, you know, nobody's perfect, can never be made perfect. And so when things go wrong, we hit setbacks, when we fail, so you inevitably will from time to time, we can recognize that that's just part of our common humanity, and that we can be kind to ourselves in those moments. We can tell ourselves that it's okay, there's always next time. We can treat ourselves like, I suppose, like you treat a friend. And that self-kindness is like taking a sledgehammer to perfectionism, because perfectionists will always tell you to go in on yourself, ask yourself how you could have been so stupid. Why did you make that mistake or do that thing wrong? And so self-compassion is, I think, is a really important one. But I think also like reframing, recognizing how far we've come, recognizing our achievements up to this point. You know, everybody listening will have achieved so much in their lives, but if all we're ever focused on is the next thing, then that robs us of, I suppose, the satisfaction and pride in those achievements. And I think sometimes it's good to take a step back, look at the bigger picture, particularly when we've hit a mistake, say, oh, you know, this has not ruined my life chances. Mm. I've come so far, it's one setback of many. And finally, I think to reframe in our minds that failure is very humanizing, it's not humiliating, and living through that mantra, not just in our own lives, but also in the way that we parent, in the way that we interact with our friends, and in the way that we mentor and teach. I think those things are really important.
Mm. Just from something that's sticking out my mind there, is it possible for perfectionism in a person to exist without the social component? You know, I'm just thinking of a Kardashian episode that I watched recently where Kim was just, you know, she has it all. She couldn't possibly want or need any more, but she's just so competitive with herself. And she's like, I need to just keep hitting these extra markers for myself. Like, but is that separate to a social thing? Because I don't really know who she could compare herself to socially when she's at that level. Is it always underpinned by a social comparison? Like, can you separate perfectionism and social comparison?
No, you can. And there's always something in the mind of a perfectionist that can be done. This is the problem actually with perfectionism, because we have in our mind's eye, if we can just reach this level of perfection, then everything will be okay.
But that's the trap then, is it? That's the trap that you talk about.
It's exactly the trap, because when we do meet it, there's something more, there's somebody better, or there's something that we've seen on an advertisement or a TV screen that will give us a little bit extra, always something. And so in that respect, perfectionism exposes our dreams as nothing more than a dead end. It's like trying to chase the horizon. The closer you get, the further it moves. And that's perfectionism in a nutshell. You know, you never will get there because you're not supposed to get there. It's in relentless striving for no particular endpoint. And that's the most exhausting, draining, and difficult thing about perfectionism. Why it makes it so problematic psychologically? Because there's never any room to savor our accomplishments or feel a sense of pride in what we have achieved. And interestingly, you bring up the Kardashians there, because even people who we see in our lives and we hold up on a pedestal as people who live these kind of perfect, luxurious lives, even they, in fact, especially they, are trapped in this hall of mirrors of limitless perfection that can never, ever, ever be met. And I would encourage all of us and all our listeners, and that's the reason why I wrote the book, is to try to recognize that that's the root, that's the problem. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to step off that treadmill and try mm-hmm. to search for acceptance and contentment instead.
I have to ask you, because you did a TED talk, which to me would seem like the most high pressured environment to come in and share in a very polished way all your thoughts and ideas. How did you make sure perfectionism didn't get in the way of your prep there, and how did you feel that you did very well? Like, obviously it goes without saying, but how, you know, having had this background and done this research, and then you put yourself in a situation that for a lot of people demands perfectionism, how was that for you?
Terrifying. And I consider myself a perfectionistic person, and certainly back then, I mean, I feel like I would manage the situation better now, but I was quite young. I was still in my 20s, late 20s, and it's daunting. It's crazy. And then you go to the US, and the US is like nothing. Like, the UK is very different to the US in many, many ways. And one of them is like these events, because if you give a talk in the UK, you're just kind of pushed on stage and told away you go. But in the US, you've got a speech coach, you've got a body language coach, You got a green room before you go on where everybody's pumping you up. And, you know, as a perfectionist, as an introvert, I just want to be left alone. Just let me go through my mind the 100 ways I can screw up this talk before I go on stage. And that's really, I suppose, the most terrifying thing. And look, you know, I overthought it. I worked way too hard on it, but I didn't screw up. Right? And I suppose for the perfectionist, like, that's the relief. When you get off the stage and you're like, oh, thank goodness. Like, you don't feel like you've achieved something. Like, oh my God, you've just stood on stage in front of all those people and I've recited those 15 minutes. That's amazing. You just feel relieved that you didn't screw it up. And that was very much me. And then in the months and weeks and months that followed, I would worry because you can't see it back. That's the other difficult thing.
Oh,
like you,
no.
And you can't do a check on it. So you don't know, like, if you made a mistake or not. And I thought I missed a line and I was ruminating about so yeah, like, these things are really, really tough. But that was, there's a lesson there too, because just putting myself out there was a really brave thing to do. And it teaches you a lot about yourself. It teaches you a lot about this kind of idealized image that you hold up in your mind, and that you actually really, you're living in fear of that person. And that's holding you back in many ways. So putting yourself out there, so, so important. And it helps break through those perfectionistic tendencies. So yes, it was difficult, but it was also very, very helpful for me too.
So you can just I'm thinking about the listener now, for something to take away, you know, obviously you can work on your self-talk going into something, like whether, okay, this project has to be perfect. Okay, we can't control the outcome, but maybe you can work on your perfectionism, sort of retrofit it after when you've done something, then that's your chance to say, well, like, let's look at what we did do and what did work. What would you want to leave the listener with as something that they can maybe put into action if they're really feeling weighed down by perfectionist thinking?
Well, the biggest one there is you don't have to, like, it doesn't have, first of all, it doesn't have to be perfect, but it doesn't have to be, like, you don't have to be world champion at something or excellent at something to put yourself out there and do it. And this is what holds back perfectionist people all the time. They feel like they're not good at it, or they're not really good at it. And therefore, in trying to stop themselves from failing because they feel like they're not good enough, they will self-sabotage their chances of success. This happens all the time. So I'd say, put yourself out there. If you don't think you're very good at public speaking, then put your hand up for a talk and just feel the discomfort. Go through the anxiety that's going to engender, at least for a little while. Just allow it in. Don't try and suppress it. And do it anyway. Feel the fear. Do it anyway. Because this is putting yourself out there, doing something that you think you're not world champion at, is so, so important. It's so, so important. And yes, you might not do it well. And it may, you know, be not very well received or whatever. That might happen, but it's okay. Because in that moment, you learn a lot about what you could do better, how you can improve. But also you find out that the impact of those bad performance or whatever it might be is not as catastrophic as you thought it was going into it. It really helps clarify. Yeah, it helps just clarify and break down some of those anxieties. And the more you can do that, you know, little steps, little steps out of your comfort zone, little by little, the more you do it, the easier it becomes and the better you get. And so perfectionists do hold themselves back a lot. They do avoid situations where they feel like they're going to be judged. It's natural, it's understandable. But I'd highly recommend the listeners to try, if you can, to realize that you don't have to be world champion at everything. Some things you're only going to be good at, and some things you're not going to be very good at, but that's also okay. And the most important thing is to put yourself out there, feel that fear, and do it anyway.
Amazing. And the book is widely available now. Is it out already?
It is out already. It's out in the UK and in the US. So if you Google The Perfection Trap, it will come up in most search engines. So yeah, please do grab a copy. And I'd love to know what listeners think. So do also feedback.
Absolutely. Well, I'll put a link in the show notes and encourage people to get buying. Tom, thank you so much for your expertise and for answering all my questions, even though there was one too many mentions of the Kardashians. I know my listeners will understand. but it's great to put it into a context, to take something that can be quite academic sounding and distill it into something that people can digest. So thank you for everything, and best of luck with the book.
Thanks, Caroline. Great to talk.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The easiest way to access Owning It Real Time is to head to the link in the episode description or episode details, whatever you call them, show notes. You will find the link in there at the top. You can sign up right away for Owning It Real Time and access the full library of 10 situation-specific audio guides that will help you own your anxiety even more than you've ever done before.